This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest James Fallows made a startling observation in a recent piece in the Atlantic Monthly. According to his estimate, there are more manufacturing jobs in the southern China province of Guangdong than in the entire United States. Fallows is living in China these days, and he's written about the enormous scale, unique methods, and widespread impact of China's fast-paced industrial revolution. James Fallows is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He's written 7 books. His most recent is Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq. I spoke to him last week about his reporting from the industrial city of Shenzhen in southern China, where hundreds of factories are located. Well, James Fallows, welcome back to Fresh Air. Describe a factory, one of these outside of Shenzhen that you visited.
Well, I'll describe one that I couldn't get into because it's like a military camp. The biggest one in that whole area, and probably the biggest factory complex on Earth that the Earth has ever seen, is a company called Foxconn. That's their English name. They have an office in Shenzhen. They are owned by a Taiwanese entrepreneur who's operated in southern China for a while. And in this one plant, something like 250,000 people go to work every single day. They live there. They eat there. They have this giant encampment. In scale, it reminded me most of, say, Los Angeles International Airport. That was about how big it was to drive around the periphery. The statistic I like best about this factory for Foxconn is that simply to feed its own workforce, the caterers have to kill 3,000 pigs every single day. You know, Chinese pigs are not that big, but still, it's a lot of pork going in there. The more typical factory, of which there are thousands probably just in the Shenzhen area, these are factories that often produce electronics, shoes, light manufactured goods with a lot of hand labor. And the typical employee will be a young woman, maybe in her early or mid-20s, who's grown up in some other part of China, in the provinces, in Sichuan province or some other rural area. And her family's income would have been about $100 a year in cash back on the farm. And when she goes to this factory in Shenzhen or neighboring city, she can make about $100 a month or $130 a month. And in the course of several years of this full-time factory work, living on the factory, eating in the factory, she can save essentially a lifetime savings. And so many of these people then either some of them stay in the city, but some of them after 3 or 4 years go back. And so you see these seas of young women all at the assembly line, some cases heavy industry young men. And it's like, in a sense, a wartime effort. They spend 24 hours a day essentially on the factory complex. And for them, it's a good economic deal.
And so in these light manufacturing plants all throughout Shenzhen, are most of the employees women?
It does seem to go by the kinds of things they're making. For example, I've seen some big places where they're making air conditioners, and most of the people there were men. But if you think of the classic made-in-China good, for example, any headsets that people might be using to listen to this show right now, or actually, in fact, any audio equipment of any sort by which people are listening to this show, whether it's on a webcast or over the radio, that most likely came from a factory in China. And in factories like those, it is predominantly young women. And it's in those factories, you see a kind of hand labor that is simply not efficient to do in the Western world anymore because, you know, if you were paying people to snap things together one every 5 seconds, 10 or 12 hours a day, the wage rates would be prohibitive in the U.S.
Now, where do the employees live and eat?
There are in the typical factory, and I'm thinking of one now owned by a company that I won't name. Well, the company I won't name because I can't actually remember its name. It's one of many anonymous small Chinese-owned manufacturers, but they would do contract work for almost any brand name you can think of in the U.S. You know, whether it's, you know, name a brand name, and that company almost certainly has its manufacturing done in China. The employees there will. They will work on the assembly line for 8, 10, 12 hours a day, depending on the workflow, and live in a dormitory. And the dormitories range from pretty gruesome of maybe 10 or 12 people or 14 people living in one small room and having essentially for themselves just a bunk area, to nicer than that, of having 2 or 3 people per room. They're not, by Chinese standards, they are tough but not abusive. And they will eat in company cafeterias. You know, they're free to eat other places, but 3 meals a day are basically part of the standard employment package in addition to the cash. So if these young women are looking to save up money to send back to their families or save themselves. They will live just in the dormitory, eat just in the company canteens, and that is their life for the several years.
You made a point in the piece that while some would regard these conditions as abusive or even equivalent to slavery, if you look at it, you believe that folks living this life are perhaps even better off than someone attempting to live on a minimum wage, say, in Chicago.
And let me stipulate, there are a lot of really abusive and terrible factories in China. And almost every day you'll see an item in the paper of somebody who, 10 people blown up in a steel mill, or, there was a horrible story of something like 36 or 37 people who were covered with molten steel in a steel plant in one day, and of course all died. So there are many factories that are dangerous, rough. There were reports of sort of slave labor factories in the north of China recently, but the average factory, at least the ones I've seen, is not that way. They are instead quite tough and demanding. But from the Chinese perspective, this has been not 100% success, but a huge success for the country in the following sense: that if you think of India, the people in India who've been able to interact with the world economy and make their way up in the world are people who already have been educated and know enough English and enough sort of sophisticated information to work in a call center or to be part of some kind of software support. And that's a numbered in the single digits of millions of people in India who are able to do that. In China, it's many tens of millions of rural peasants who've been able to have a tenfold increase in their cash income by going to the factories. And the contrast with somebody on the minimum wage in the U.S., that a person, it is almost impossible for somebody on the minimum wage in the U.S. to move ahead. Saving, it is, you can imagine scenarios in which people could save money and feel as if they could have a better future if they're on the minimum wage in the U.S. But anybody working in a factory in China knows that his or her future is much, much brighter than their families would have been, than their future would have been if they were still in the countryside, or than past generations of Chinese uneducated people have enjoyed. So in these factories, of course there are complaints. Of course there are searches for better situations. Of course there are things that need to be fixed. But the average sentiment in the factories, as I was able to find out about it, seemed to be that this was an opportunity from their point of view because they were having the equipment for a better life.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with journalist James Fallows. He is living in China and studying industrialization there and writing for The Atlantic. China is still a one-party state and, at least in theory, a socialist country. Who owns all of these scores of factories in the Shenzhen area?
What exactly socialism and communism mean in China now is a very rich topic, and you could argue that communist China is less a welfare state than the United States is or any part of Europe, because there's no retirement program, no health insurance program for most people. The actual ownership of the means of production in the most productive parts of China is mainly through small business people, often Taiwanese. And the typical factory in southern China where the goods Americans buy every day ultimately come from, it will be probably a family-owned enterprise, more likely than not a family that has some ties to Taiwan and they've come across the straits to southern China to operate, or some small business from the area. But they're small enterprises in really cutthroat competition with each other to take this next 0.5% out of their bidding price to Dell or Hewlett-Packard or Sony or whoever they're doing the contract work for. So it's a more classic and really every single day competitive model of small-scale capitalism than we see in a lot of America now.
And so what we have in this area, this province north of Hong Kong, are hundreds and hundreds of small manufacturers and a kind of a frenetic competition, really, to supply international companies with parts and components of all kinds of things, a lot of them electronics, right?
Exactly.
And one of the points you make is that a Chinese company could respond very quickly to the need of an American manufacturer to bring on a new product line or to make a change in a component part. Why are these Chinese factories, which are so labor intensive, able to deliver so quickly and so cheaply to these American or these international needs?
I spent a lot of time in my reporting and in my article talking about a man named Liam Casey, who's one of the sort of he's one of a number of central figures in the whole outsourcing business. He exists to put Western-branded companies in touch with Chinese manufacturing firms that can do their actual production work for them, either firms as large, let's say, as Apple, or firms as small as some startup that has an idea and needs to get it produced to bring to the American market. And a point that Liam Casey made to me again and again and again is that people think the Chinese manufacturing advantage is just that things are cheap. And, of course, they are cheap. And if you have people making $100 a month, that's quite different from the U.S. Labor cost. But he said that even more than that, the profound advantage that Chinese manufacturing had now was that it was so fast and flexible and responsive and adaptable because all parts of the production chain were there in one place. If you needed to have a small piece of leather, you know, tooled in some way, you know, 1 inch by 4 inches with a certain number of perforations, there were 5 companies that could have you samples tomorrow afternoon. And if you were working in Dusseldorf or you were working in New York, you know, maybe you'd have one supplier, maybe they could do something next month. So it's this whole ramified network of all the different parts of the modern manufacturing experience, which now are more and more concentrated in China, in particular this part of southern China. And the companies, the firms that do the connections between the Western customers and the Chinese producers, their specialty is knowing how to put these pieces together, saying, you want this piece of plastic in red of just this dimension, here are the 5 companies that can bid on it, and I'll have them all for you to see tomorrow, and you'll see who gets the business.
And this gentleman that you mentioned, who you describe as Mr. China, he's made kind of a life of, I think you said he has actual GPS coordinates for all kinds of Chinese manufacturing locations. Not stuff you can get in any directory or in any government registry, right? It's a matter of knowing the terrain?
Exactly. And part of the problem is that maps literally are out of date the instant they appear because roads are being both built and destroyed so rapidly in China and new factories and new buildings. And so knowing simply where things are is a big competitive advantage.
You say in the piece that 90% of the laptop and notebook computers sold in the world under all these famous brand names come from Chinese companies in this part of southern China. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And it doesn't matter that you can name any brand a notebook computer, whether it's a ThinkPad, whether from Lenovo or IBM or a Sony or an HP or a Dell, or you go down the list. And it is almost certain that it comes from one of 5 no-name Taiwanese companies that have these factories in China, some around Shanghai, some in southern China. They do the actual production of almost all the notebook and laptop computers in the world.
One of the interesting sections of your piece in The Atlantic detailed how an online order would come in for Liam Casey's company, and exactly how quickly the factory would respond and get it out. If you could just kind of run that down for us.
I enjoyed very much seeing this place, so I'll tell you the process. And once again, I can't tell you the name of the American brand this is sold under, although I guarantee that every single person listening to this knows the name of this American-based consumer electronics company. So this company has a website, and on the website, people can order devices, they can order accessories, they can order all kinds of stuff, like any other website you go to for a major American brand product. There's a 12-hour time difference between the U.S. East Coast and China time, so the factory in China works sort of on reverse from American time. And while I was there in the wee hours of the morning, China time, which was late afternoon in America, I saw a person, a man, in fact, from Palatine, Illinois, who was browsing around on the website, you know, for this American manufacturer, and saw something he wanted and clicked on the Buy Now button. And within a few seconds, 10,000 miles away in Shenzhen, the order form was printed out, complete with a barcode. And the barcode specified all the details. So on the other end of the internet, this order comes out, and a series of young Chinese women took it. The first one scanned it in and then produced the address label that would be used for this man. It also had the packing box. Next person on down started putting in the main thing this person had ordered. The next one on down checked the barcode and had a so-called pick-to-light process where there was a big, essentially a wall-sized array of little tiny cubby holes, like a sort of a post office box array. And whatever item had been called for by the barcode specs, the light would go on over that thing. And so the young woman would pick off that accessory. She would run its barcode across a scanner, like in a grocery store, put it into the box. At that point, there would be a very, very sensitive scale, which would say, okay, we know these three components are supposed to be in here. Does the weight in grams equal exactly what we think it should be? It would go then to the next person, who would rescan the things to make sure they were fine, and somebody else to pack it up. And then the interesting part to me is they were put into these shipping boxes and then assembled on big shipping pallets, you know, maybe a cube essentially 5 feet in all dimensions. And these were for the shipping company, either FedEx or DHL or UPS, to pick up, you know, a few hours later. And when the shipper's deadline came, pickup time, let's say it's 9 a.m. China time, 9 p.m. U.S. East Coast time, suddenly all activity in the factory in China was focused on this moment. The shippers would come in, they'd take off these pallets, and they'd rush them to Hong Kong Airport. On the flights to Anchorage, there'd be some preliminary sorting, you know, which ones to the East Coast, which ones to the West Coast, and they'd all be arrayed. And within 36 hours of the time the customer in Illinois clicked on the Buy Now button, you know, triggering this event, the package would show up at his or her door, you know, via FedEx.
It's fascinating to read these descriptions of these factories and kind of the level of competition and how integrated they are into international markets. But let's look at evaluate it a bit. Is this good for China? How do you read it?
From the Chinese perspective, I would have to say, as I think most Chinese people feel, this is overwhelmingly good from a Chinese perspective. Here are the bad parts. One bad part from the Chinese perspective is the U.S. has effectively outsourced a fair amount of pollution to China. You know, as factories have gone, so have factory smokestacks and all the rest. And the pollution in China is unbelievably horrible. It's the single greatest threat that country faces, and I think the world faces, because of China's industrialization. So that is one cost they absorb. A second cost they absorb is there is some downside to factory life, where young men and women are spending 3 or 4 years, you know, just essentially on full-time labor detail. This is hard on them. It's hard on their families. It has all kinds of, you know, their social side effects of alienation, drug use, crime, and all the rest that have been part of industrialization through history. That is a problem. And there are, you know, the side effects of kind of uncontrolled growth. Those are the things which be problems from the Chinese point of view. On the other hand, you do now have tens of millions of people, perhaps, you know, 100 million people or more, who have, thanks to the factory life, been able to make the leap from really hand-to-mouth existence on the farm to having enough cash that they can have other choices. They can pay for their children to go to school. They can set up little businesses. They can get married. And so I think the Chinese view their factory life as being the great success story of the last generation.
You're just joining us. We're speaking with journalist James Fallows. He has been living in China, where he is writing about that country's efforts at industrialization for The Atlantic. One of the questions that comes to mind as you look at the industrialization in China is whether a one-party state can continue to rule over a country which becomes more urban and more part of a capitalist monetary economy. I mean, do you see signs that of you know, what is in effect a kind of a backward and corrupt political structure straining against or struggling with the needs of capitalists to do what they need to do?
You know, this is a fascinating and rich question which people in China, especially outsiders, but a number of Chinese too, debate every single day. And I think nobody has any confidence in predicting what will happen in the long run. My observation of the tension between the political system and the economic system is a little different from what I think the normal outside American observation would be. You know, we usually think as a country prospers, it has to become more democratic or else it'll be cut off. I think the limit on China is slightly different from that. You know, China, as I've been saying, at the moment is very, very strong in quite low-wage manufacturing jobs. The question, you know, their hope, America's apprehension, is whether they can move to take the higher-level positions too. And it's observed around the world that those higher level positions, you know, having fundamental new inventions, having really good industrial designers, having real product innovations. So you're not just making an existing product cheaper, but you're coming up with a truly new one. They're associated with democratic societies, but even more, I think they're associated with another set of traits. They're associated with very strong universities where you can have independent research. China's universities are quite weak. You know, they're not good in independent research at all. They're associated with intellectual property protection so that people can make money from their inventions. China's intellectual property protection is ridiculously weak. You know, everything is up for grabs from everybody. They're associated with rule of law and sanctity of contract. You know, if you make a deal, you'll have a deal, which is generally not the case in China. They're associated with a kind of ethic of trust so that people can operate without everything having to be written down. And there's quite a pronounced lack of trust in China, which is why firms are typically so small. They don't trust, you know, people who are not their families to operate. And so I am persuaded of the argument that for China really to take the next step in prosperity, it needs to have a lot of these other cultural conditions, better universities, a more trustworthy legal system, better copyright laws and all the rest. The question is, does that mean a democratic political system too? I think for China to really prosper in a profound way, it would need to be a society of civil liberties and a more society of kind of independent inquiry and independent voices. Whether that means actual political competition for power and having some other party besides the communists in the mix, I just don't know. And I think the calculation of the current leadership is they think they can stick with this model for a while.
Do you see signs that workers in Chinese factories are restive, that they feel exploited and maybe want to organize unions or seek redress of grievances from the government or their owners?
This is one of many places where I should say that you know, anybody who presumes to say what's happening in, quote, China, unquote, is nuts, because it's so big and so diverse. So I can talk about what I've seen in a lot of factories in one part of China. My impression is that there are – you know, the workers there are by no means docile and by no means just satisfied with whatever happens. And one reason why at a lot of work sites, mobile phones are outlawed is that Chinese people love mobile phones. Almost everybody has them, even peasants, and they send text messages around the clock. And in the factories, they'll often be sending text messages saying, hey, we can get, you know, 2 RMB a day more at this other factory. Come to this other factory. So mobile phones are a way of both complaining about conditions and seeking better options. And there is considerable activity among Chinese workers. In the factories I saw, however, there was neither some sense of sullen oppression and people just looking to rise up against the man and overthrow them and, you know, lash out against their hated oppressors. And more it was people who were working very, very hard to get their money. Nor were unions really the answer, because in unions, in China, unions are essentially another branch of the state. China is the only part of the world where Walmart is unionized, and they had to be, to operate there. And essentially, the unions work as part of the Communist Party structure, so they're not really a way to exercise leverage for what we think of as real workers' rights.
How much has Chinese manufacturing been damaged by the scandals over, food contamination? There was dog food, toothpaste.
I think that there is a clear sense in China that the so-called China brand has been very, very seriously hurt by all the legitimate problems they've had. And by legitimate, I mean real problems, or the not just a perception of unsafe Chinese products, but the reality of that. The reaction in the Chinese press has been interesting to me, in that the minor theme has been, oh, the foreigners are blaming us, they're picking on us, you know, they have their own bad products too, it's not just us. The major theme has been, this is a problem for us, we need to clean it up, what are the ways we can redress it? So they recognize, on the one hand, that when consumers have options in the Western world, they may steer away from Chinese vegetables or Chinese processed food or Chinese toothpaste. And the people in China don't have that much choice. But there are a whole lot of things in which, for Western consumers, the Chinese component is either not obvious or it's not avoidable. You know, if you wanted to buy a non-Chinese-made computer, well, good luck. You know, you're not going to find one. So I think they recognize this is, like pollution, a genuine problem, and dealing with it is another issue.
Well, James Fallows, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. You can download podcasts of the show at freshair.npr.org.